Well, you'll know this guy. Rivers Rutherford is a name that is synonymous with about 4,000 songs and every artist that's ever come into Nashville. I'm going to go through a couple real quick. Just to kind of put in perspective the different types of sounds you get from Rivers. Chuck Wicks was nice enough to come in. He loaded a bunch of songs for me. Stealing Cinderella, actually, Chuck's song is one that you've got to co-write on.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll start with that.
She was playing Cinderella. She was riding her first bike. Bouncing on the bed and looking for a pillow fight. Running through the sprinkler. Big popsicle grin, dancing with the dad, looking up at him.
So there's a little bit of that. So obviously, having the history you have with Chuck and the fact that he's on the show with me, was excited about having you be here today because he was like, man, Rivers is an awesome guy. So he gave me a bunch of songs. You know, he mentioned that Tim McGraw is an artist you've worked with in the past. He gave me this clip.
She was playing Cinderella.
That's not Tim.
It didn't sound like Tim. Hold on.
Sounds like a pretty boy. Well, I guess Tim's a pretty boy, too.
Yeah, Montgomery Gentry, If You Ever Stop Loving Me.
She was playing Cinderella.
Again, Faith Hill, When the Lights Go Down.
She was playing Cinderella.
I feel like I see what's going on here. Okay, while we do the podcast.
I get where he's going with this. You know, it's funny because the truth is I've only had one hit, and that was with Chuck Wicks. It's called Stealing Cinderella, in case you didn't catch that.
If you ask him. Actually, we have an executive producer on the show as well. His name is Glenn. Glenn had some Tim McGraw, and just as an example, Real Good Man is a song that you were a huge part of.
I may be a real bad boy, but baby, I'm a real good man.
All right, just a little bit of that. So there's two sides to Rivers Rutherford right there. It's the soft side and the jam.
Yeah, well, you pretty much pegged me, I think. I'm a big mush at heart, and then the older I get, dadgum, television commercials make me cry. I cry at everything. It's crazy.
Well, are you a parent? I do.
I have children. I've got four children. And I think the older they get, the more, I don't know, you just get emotional. You see milestones in their life, and it kills you. But down deep, I'm just kind of ornery, I guess.
Yeah. You got both sides still?
Yeah, I still do.
For me, I think you should know, and I kind of mentioned this off the air, but songwriters to me are the epitome of what music is. I'm the most fascinated by songwriters because you're the reason the song was created.
Well, thank you. I came to Nashville in 1993, but I started kind of making business trips up here in probably 88. That's when I signed my first publishing deal. And I went to the Bluebird and saw Don Schlitz, Fred Knobloch, Paul Overstreet, and Craig Bickhart. SKOB, they call themselves. And I didn't like country music. I wasn't listening to country radio. I was kind of an R&B guy. And so I go to the Bluebird because that's where they said all the up-and-comers went. And I sit down. I just signed a publishing deal. I was all excited. And I'm watching these guys play hit after hit after hit and had never heard them before. And so I'm thinking, my gosh, if these guys hadn't made it, I'm never going to make it. You know, these songs are amazing.
Sure.
But of course, I found out these were all number one songs we were playing, but seeing the songwriter play his song sort of uninterpreted, it's like I liken it unto reading a book that was written in Spanish, you know, if you could read Spanish, I could, in its original language. You know, it may not be as polished and, you know, as much of a singer kind of thing, but there's something about it.
It's the original message.
I guess so. Yeah, the message that guy was trying to get across really does come across.
I live by the Bluebird now a little bit, and it's very cool for me. I'm a kid from South Dakota. I grew up in the Midwest. And,
oh, nice.
Yeah, but it's always been the songwriter for me, and that's why I think I originally fell in love with music. Interestingly enough, I ended up marrying a songwriter, and you
all
know, it's
right.
Just, it's sort of like it's just kind of finding me over and over. So the thing we start with at the very beginning is the rule. If you as a songwriter go into a room, what is the rule? And it doesn't have to be necessarily something you hold yourself to, but if a new songwriter were coming to ask you for like one lesson, what's the rule? Christian Bush said, I always write about a wish. Liz Rose says, I always just want the truth, and it comes down to the lyric for me, the one lyric that builds off of.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've written, you kind of touched on two different things there. I think the sort of the method and then the overarching philosophy of it. And
we'll come back to the method, but if we're going to continue this podcast with one philosophy, what is that for you?
Yeah, for me, I would probably agree with both Liz and Christian. I mean, you know, it's, I love that, the wish, that's really good. When I get a concept for a song, I may have a title, or it may be just a a mood, a piece of music that I'm playing that's kind of a mood that creates. It may just be I want to write about my daughter, whatever it is. I take, and when I find some words I kind of like, particularly a hook, I kind of drop it, I say, down the well of my subconscious, as it were, and see what it catches on. And so somebody else may tell, for instance, I wrote a song called When I Get Where I'm Going, with a guy named George Tarrant. And at the time, George and I, we were hitting pretty well, writing, having some good success together. And we had created this little character we called Rodney. Now, George is from up east, you know, he's a gun control advocate, New England liberal, you know, I mean, he's a centrist, but I always tease him. But, I'm a gun guy. You know, I like to hunt and that kind of thing. So, I'd say a line and he'd go, I don't really like that. And he'd say a line. I'd go, George, you know, that's not real country.
Yeah.
And finally we came up with this character. And so one of us would look at the other one and say, well, would Rodney say that?
Right.
And the other guy would say, probably not. So he comes in one day and he's got this Rodney idea. He tells me, when I get where I'm going, well, first thing I thought of was heaven. My grandfather just died. So I said, how's that a Rodney idea? He said, well, when I get where I'm going, baby, don't leave me because you'll be glad you stuck around when I get where I'm going. And I said, oh, great. And we started working on it. But, and I couldn't get the heaven thing out of my mind. And so I said, this is what I think. And he said, yeah, I thought about that. And I said, well, you want to write a gospel song and not make any money? And to his credit, he kind of stopped. And he said, all right. And neither one of us thought I'd get cut. But the point being that it was what I felt. I think the best songs that I've written have come from real, you know, the uber me is what I say.
Yeah.
I look for the you know, we're all complicated packages of people, but you just kind of boiled me down to two things earlier, and that's where I've had my success. It's the kind of ornery, rough, but sentimental guy.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, what I took away from that, and I don't want to put words, if you're not comfortable with this being the rule, this is the one I'm moving forward with otherwise. Okay. Is that you plant a seed, whatever that was to you, it was a lyric or it was a Rodney or it was an idea, and then you see what grows into a song.
That's it. I'd say that's right. You know, to me, it's like fishing off of a pier. Yeah, you go fishing in the Gulf, you go offshore, you're going to catch billfish. You go by a wreck, you're going to catch grouper and all that kind of thing. You throw a hook off a pier, you never know what you're going to come up with.
Right.
You know, and that's to me is like what writing songs is. I try to aim it for the market as best I can, put a little English on the ball, so to speak, but more or less, I'm just setting something in motion and see what develops.
So when you walk into a session, what's the first thing that happens?
Depends on who I'm writing with. You know, you earlier alluded to a new aspiring songwriter. You know, if I'm going to write with a new aspiring songwriter, I kind of expect that kid to come in with a title or an idea or a few. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm writing with one of my guys that I write with regularly, we come in and kind of chat and somebody says, well, here, I got an idea. And we'll scroll through a few of them. And it could be a piece of music. It could be a title. It could be just a concept. I want to write a song about, you know, the Revolutionary War, whatever. And then we kind of talk about it for a minute. And again, we kind of sit back and I just try to find that place in my subconscious or whatever that rings.
Yeah.
When I think of that title, you know?
So you plant that seed.
Yeah.
And then it's like, you just sort of, you play off each other until you come up with.
Yeah. People start spitting stuff out. I say in any co-writing relationship, there's usually one guy that's kind of an idea guy, like a generator. He's throwing stuff out constantly. The other guy's kind of like an editor. Mm-hmm. That's not universally true, but it works best in my co-writes. And with George Tarrant, for instance, we wrote so much together that we would swap hats so quickly, neither one of us really knew who was wearing what hat, but it worked, you know. And a big part of it, I think, is trusting your co-writer, too. If you see passion, I don't even look for necessarily quality. I look for the passion in the other person's eyes. And if it's not a great line, I figure, let's go with the concept. We can fix the line later, you know.
Absolutely. Well, and when you write with people, I'm looking at a list of like the songs that you've written that then become a cut for whomever it may be. Brooks and Dunn, Down the Hall Kicks. Brooks does our ACC, our American Country Countdown. Ain't Nothing About You. Where you look, where you laugh, where you love with all you have, there ain't nothing about you. And don't do something for me. Where you kiss, where you cry, where you move when you walk by, there ain't nothing about you. That's you.
Yeah, that was me and Tom Shapiro, actually. And that's a great example. I just had a few hits. I'd never had a number one. I had just a handful of, you know, nice hits, but not a number one. And I woke up, I'm shaving, and I thought, oh, man, what am I doing today? I thought, I'm right with Tom Shapiro. I thought, oh, crap. Shapiro's the songwriter of the decade for the 90s, and I don't have an idea. You know, this was in 2000.
You're the new kid who needs to come in with an idea right
now. Yeah, exactly. And I got nervous, man, and I got in the shower, and I started singing, and when I walked in, we exchanged pleasantries, really great guy, and really put you at ease, you know. He said, "We got an idea," and I said, "Well, I had this little thing in the shower, and I don't know really what to do with it, and I can't even play it because I hadn't picked up a guitar this morning yet. Let me learn it." And I picked the guitar up, and I kind of fumbled my way through it, and I said, "I've got this yearning in the deep part of my heart for you." And he said, "Oh, I like that." And we just kind of, he said, "Well, I had a thought this morning coming in." I said, "What?" He said, "There ain't nothing about you that don't do something for me." And I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed. When he said that, I said, "Huh. It's kind of clumsy, isn't it?"
That's how you felt about that line?
It felt like it clunked. Yeah. You know, it just kind of didn't have a ring or a portrait to it. And he kind of looked at me and he said, "Yeah, it's clunky. Let's see what we can do with it." And I said, "Okay." I trusted him. And God, I'm so glad I did. I mean, you know, Shapiro's had 28 number ones, I think. We finished the song, and really, we got halfway through it. We got to the second verse, and he said, "I could hear Trace Atkins doing this." And I said, "I think we got a Backstreet Boys song. This isn't country."
What? So you went right down the middle instead.
Yeah. And he said, "Why do you say that?" And I said, "There's no man in this song at all. It's just," and he said, "Well, man it up." And I said, "In my life, I've been hammered by some heavy blows," in the second verse. And he kind of grinned, and we wrote it. Well, neither one of us thought there was anything to it. Didn't care. Do you want to demo this? I don't know. What do you think? I don't know. But fortunately, our publishers talked us into demoing it, and of course, it was a big hit.
And how do you get that information? When you find out that you're about to get a cut, I mean, if you write it with an artist, you kind of get a vibe that they're interested in it. But if you don't...
Yeah, oh man, it's a definitely walking in the dark by faith, you know. But yeah, you throw a song, you know, you demo it and get to play it around, and your publisher or you might play it for a producer or a record label or an artist, and somebody says, "I want to hold that." Uh-huh. Or I really like that. I want to take a copy of it. But a hold is like a movie option with no money changing hands. Right. So it's kind of a gentleman's agreement. I won't play this for anybody else, and you're going to give me an answer as quick as you can about whether you cut it. And so it's a very loose arrangement. But you get a song on hold, you get excited. But generally a song goes on hold, could go on hold several times, and nobody ever cuts it. You know, the first big hold I got, I remember, it went on hold, and then there were 14 backups to the hold. Nobody cut it. Heartbreaking. And Ain't Nothing About You was on hold two or three times before it finally landed with Brooks and Dunn.
So you get the hold, and then eventually you find out maybe that you get the cut. And then the other step is you find out it's going to be a single.
Well, you find out it's going to be on the record. You know, I've had plenty of heartbreak stories there. I remember I won't name the band, but it was a huge band in country music at the time. And they cut a song of mine, and it was, man, this is the first single title track. And the record came out, and I went to go buy it. And it wasn't the title track, and then I looked over on the back side of it, and it wasn't even on the record.
Wow. Yeah,
that was 2 weeks later. So you never really know until you can hear it on the radio.
If you're choosing how to write, do you find that it's different when you're writing with the artist themselves and when you're writing with just your pals,
yes,
songwriters?
Yeah, absolutely. Because with an artist, he's the ultimate outlet for the song. I mean, he's my customer, so to speak. So if he says, "I don't like that," well, I don't care how great it is. He's not going to record it. That ain't the line.
It's a tailored suit.
You're taking out all the middlemen. You're going right to the consumer and custom writing a song for them. So,
but is that a better way to do it? Because now you do know that you're tailoring it.
It has advantages for sure. I think you can really get inside the artist's head. On the other hand, you know, I know a lot of artists who are great songwriters. I know a lot of artists that aren't, and I know some who could easily be great songwriters if they had more time to hone the craft, so to speak. So, you know, I love getting in a room with a guy that is a writer, doesn't make any records. We're just going to write a song to try to pitch to somebody because, you know, he, like myself, goes in every day and writes songs. And over years and years and years, he's gotten really good at it. So it's just an easy, how do I say it? You got two master craftsmen working on a cabinet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like minds.
Yeah, like minds, I guess. And with an artist, if you're not getting the feeling that he really loves this, you know, you don't know what you're going to wind up with at the end of the day. So, or she really loves it. On the other hand, you know, you get immediate feedback on whether this thing is going to get recorded or not.
Yeah.
You know? So you can, if you sense that they're not into it, man, there's no question that in the right line, where another writer and I might sit there and go, "I don't know, I really like that."
Do you have an inkling when you actually write a song if it's going to get some traction?
You know, that's a great question. And I'd have to say the answer is absolutely not. I know if it feels like something good to me, but I've had one song in my entire career that I thought was a hit from day one, and that was Real Good Man.
Which went to McGraw.
Yeah.
Which, did we play that yet, or did I just tell you about
you
it?
You played a little snippet of
that's
it.
That's right.
Yeah,
I couldn't remember.
Hey, I always like hearing it played again. Come
yeah,
on.
Here. This is Real Good Man.
I may be a real bad boy, but baby, I'm a real good man.
Now that it's played that long, it qualifies as an actual spin, and you have to pay me for it. Go ahead.
I don't think the money comes out of my pocket. There are a couple songs like that, though, where I feel you've got just traction out of the gate, whether it's the first line or whatever it is, that it just catches you immediately. Even that Kenny song, right? Like, All of a sudden, it's just the guitar hook catches you. Trace, I think, is one.
She's riding in the middle of his pickup truck. Blair and Charlie Daniels yelling, turn it up. They raised her up a lady, but there's one thing they couldn't avoid. Ladies love country boys.
Yeah.
It had to be built around that line, right? Ladies love country boys.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, well, let me think. No, it wasn't.
The hook came.
That's right. That's funny. You said that. George Stanner and I were writing with Jamie Johnson, and we just started playing. We were both kind of rough around the edges and probably a little too macho for our own good, you know?
Yeah.
And sort of spitting out that first verse, when we got to the hook, we kind of looked at one another and what were we going to say now? And I said, what about ladies love country boys? And Jamie says, I like that. And he said, there's one thing they couldn't avoid. Late. I said, oh, that's great, man. And then he didn't cut it, and I thought, dead copyright. Wasted day. Then Trace turned around and recorded it, and oh, man.
So you thought it was going to be Jamie's song for a minute there?
Oh, yeah, we thought for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, he dug it. He loved it. And then when he didn't cut it, I was heartbroken.
So Rodney Atkins, to me, there are two places you can go with this, and you can start either place, and it's just as catchy right out of the gate. So I think this is the hook first. These are my people.
These are my people. This is where I come from.
You could do it there, or you could go all the way back to the beginning. And I still feel like it's like, boom, you're in it.
Well, we grew up down by the railroad track, shooting BBs at old beer cans.
It's a story out of the gate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wrote that song with Dave Berg, great songwriter. He came in with that first line, actually first couple of lines. Grew up down by the railroad track, shooting BBs at old beer cans, and I was in. I said, choking on the smoke from a lucky strike. Somebody lifted off their old man, and he said, we were football flunkies, rock and roll junkies, cranking up the stereo. And then we got to the chorus, and, you know, we didn't have a hook. Didn't know what we were going to say. So I love that song, My Town, that Montgomery Gentry recorded. Jeffrey Steele, a couple others wrote it. And I said, what about These Are My People? Because I used to say that all the time. These are my people. I grew up in Memphis, and there's some whack jobs down there. But when I came to Nashville and got on Music Row, you know, you had everybody. I always felt like a square peg, you know. And everybody on Music Row had one foot on the floor and one foot on the ceiling. I thought, these are my people. So when I said it, yeah, we kind of dinked with the chorus. And he said, that sounds too much like My Town, man. Let's do something else. And we left it there for about a year. And he came back in. We were writing every Monday at that time. And he came in one day. He said, man, we started this thing a year ago. And he ran it down. And I said, what's wrong with that, dude? That's great. He said, that's what's wrong with it. You know, and oh, God, sorry, man. Cause I'm ADD squirrely, you know. I lose interest really quick, but I didn't that day, and we finished it.
Man, see, that's fun to me, is where you go, hey, we started with this one line, it turned into everything. And then also, it's interesting to me that every once in a while, somebody will bring something back, because I would forget it. I'd never find it again.
Oh, man.
Are there songs that you've written that you will never forget, even though nobody ever cut them?
Yep.
Do you have one of those in your back pocket if we grab
sure.
that guitar that came off your motorcycle?
Yeah. Let's see. I got a bunch of them. I mean,
And this is over how many years of songwriting? When's the first song you ever wrote, whether it's professional or not?
The first song I wrote was in, it would have been 76. I was 9 years old. My dad is a frustrated singer-songwriter, and I learned to play guitar out of a Big Elvis Orange Songbook growing up in Memphis.
That's Memphis, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I lived about four blocks from Graceland. That's where I grew up. And so Dad, we'd sit in the kitchen at night and sing, and you know, I'd play my guitar and I'd play chords until he went, that's the right chord. And then that's how I learned how to play songs. But we both sing very loud. And my mother, he asked her one night, what do you want to hear? And she said, nothing. She was getting tired of this. So I went back to my room, wrote this little song called Nothing, you know, as a smart aleck. And my dad said, that's pretty good. You ought to keep doing that.
Yeah.
And I never stopped.
Is that what we're going to get, or which one are you going to play?
I don't know if I could play that one or not. I'm trying to think of... Well, that's as close as I'm going to get it. And let me grab a pick here real quick. I tell you what, this is a relatively new song. It's about a year, little over a year, well, about a year old. But it's I've played it for a few people, and everybody seems to like it, but nobody wants to record it. It's kind of like being on the match game or something.
Yeah. So we can introduce this as up for grabs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I hear you laughing, and I can just imagine what happens. The angels are clapping and saying, look what God made. Even just smiling, it's like you get me flying. The sky is like trying to widen and getting out of my way. I'm so high, I think I'll call you champagne. You're like a million tiny bubbles on my brain. Even though I'm sober as a Sunday and doing like I should, make me feel good. You don't even have to touch me. Touch me. Looking at you makes me happy. I tell you why. Cause you doing you like you're doing it. Does it for me. You make me feel good. I grew up thinking that if I started drinking and smoking the weed on the weekend, then that was being a man. But my mind is changing, cause I can hear me saying, quit playing and go find a diamond to buy as big as you can. You're so fine, that look you got is so strong. The kind of thing they bank that moving money on. And I know my eyes can lead my heart wrong, but this time I know it's real. Cause you make me feel good. You don't even have to touch me. To touch me. Looking at you makes me happy. I tell you why. Baby, you doing you like you're doing it. Does it for me. You make me feel good. You make me feel good. Keep making me feel good. Come on, baby. Make me feel good. You make me feel. You make me feel good. You make me feel so good. You're like a million tiny bubbles. You made me feel good. You don't even have to touch me. To touch me. Looking at you makes me happy. I tell you why. You doing you like you're doing it. Does it for me. Keep doing just like you're doing, girl. You make me feel good. That's just fun to me, you know.
Yeah, man, you grew up in Memphis. Dang. Yeah.
There's a little, like I say, I grew up loving R&B and rock and roll, you know.
Yeah. Where'd you start that song? What did it, what was the little nugget? What was the seed?
That. I was sitting with Stephen Dale Jones, who's a great songwriter and an old friend of mine. We wrote another song that nobody ever recorded. I'll play just a little bit of it for you. But we didn't have a title. We didn't have an idea or anything. And I said, man, that feels good. Let's just write a song. You make me feel good, you know. But we wrote a song one time that says, Chestnut. Well, this song was recorded, but it wasn't a hit.
Okay.
I don't think it was a single either. Chestnut hair with just a touch of gray. Shadows of a few more years on her face. That ain't the girl that I knew yesterday. Oh, no, now that's a woman. Up and at it at the crack of dawn. Ain't always time to get her makeup on. But she's more beautiful without it on. Oh, yeah, now that's a woman. Yeah, it goes on and on, but I love that one, too. So I could play you songs that weren't recorded that are my favorites till tomorrow morning.
And is a lot of that, does it have to do with the fact that it's maybe just something that was more personal taste and you had to get it out of you?
Yeah,
It wasn't written for commercial purposes necessarily?
Yeah, that's another, kind of goes back to the philosophy thing. I write songs for me. I had the most success when I was writing a song that if I had had a record deal, I would have recorded it. you know, even though it might be something that I thought, nobody's going to say this. I don't know why I'm even bothering with this. Ain't nothing about you was like that. When I get where I'm going, if you ever stop loving me, Montgomery Gentry, that to me was just a rock and roll song. That riff is where we started from, and you know, it was a hit. I write for an audience of one.
Well, let's, for a second, note the fact that you are a songwriter of one. There's got to be exciting moments in a career. Think about an artist that just blew you away, that they picked your song. Because you just mentioned When I Get Where I'm Going, and for me, one of the artists on this song, even above another, would have done it for me.
Yeah, when I get where I'm going, there'll be only happy tears.
So that's Brad Paisley, but there's just a hint of Dolly back there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was pretty crazy. Brad, I wrote, you know, obviously we wrote it when my grandfather died, and shortly after we wrote it, Brad's aunt died, who he was real close to. We were in a supper club together, and my wife, who's completely the most non-planning, plotting business person, you know, and she's just not a business person, just as a gesture, as a kind of a sympathy card, gave a copy of the song to Kim and said, you know, this really helped River Sue, his grandfather's deal. Maybe it'll help Brad. And Brad called me the next day. Hey, I heard that song Allie was pitching to Kim. And I said, Brad, she wasn't pitching you a song. You know, come on. He said, no, I'm not going to cut it, but I love the song. And I said, oh, yeah, glad you do, man. I hope it helps. And he called me a few months later and said, can you come down to the studio and play guitar while I sing? Or sing while I play guitar. I said, yeah, and he cut it. And I thought, okay, it'll be the hidden track on the record or whatever, if it makes anything. And then he calls me. He says, man, we're gonna finish that out. I really like this song. It's growing on me. I said, great. And then about 2 weeks later, Kim called me. She said, Rivers, Brad just brought Dolly in. You've got to hear this. Where are you? I was out of town. I said, I can't get there, but put Brad on the phone. And she said, okay, hold on 1 second. And then she comes back and she says, he says he'll call you back when he quits crying. And I said, oh, Dolly must have killed it. And I was really excited. And obviously she did. What an honor that was.
Any time that Dolly Parton is on a... for me, it's still that way with that... the big country thing that came out last year, Forever Country.
Yeah, oh, wasn't that killer? Yeah.
Jeez, I mean, I don't know if that's generational or if that's how Dolly always was perceived, was just like, just so genuine, just a heart. She's all heart. Big, big heart.
Big heart.
But she...
a lot of room for that heart in there. Go ahead.
But she is just such an entity in music. Is there someone else that stands out, you know, taking those two out of the equation for a second, that you were... Whether it was your point in your career or the song, because you loved it so much that you were just so overwhelmed that that person chose to cut your song?
Yeah, well, all of them. I mean, the fact that anybody that has a record deal would stake their career on some small part of their career on my idea is flattering, and it humbles me every time it happens. But I will say that probably in 1989, I signed my first publishing deal on my 21st birthday, which was June 17th, 88. And I was writing for a guy named Chips Moman. Rest his soul, he died last summer, and he discovered me, as it were, and introduced me to the music business. 8 months later, he took me into a studio here in Nashville. We opened the door, and there was Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, and Kris Kristofferson, the Highwaymen.
Yeah.
The room kind of got quiet because nobody knew who I was, and I'm this kid with a black leather jacket, you know, and a mullet. We walked in, and Chip says, Riv, play your song for these boys. And I played him my song, and they cut it. It was my first cut. I kid around and say my career's been downhill ever since. But
it's hard to go uphill from the Highwaymen.
Well, I mean, where do you go from them? You know, yeah. It was great. It was an amazing time.
You did go to Chuck Wicks.
I did go to Chuck. You know,
she was playing Cinderella. She was riding.
I mean, honestly, pick a name. Any button you want to put. Hey, here's Faith Hill. When the lights go down,
she was playing Cinderella.
Oh, you mentioned Jamie Johnson, Heartache.
She was playing Cinderella.
That one was just a guess.
She was riding.
Yeah, but Chuck's. You know, every morning, obviously, we spend hours and hours together.
Y'all have a good time.
We do have a good time. Exactly.
Yeah, I can tell.
He is an artist, but at the same time, he's just a passionate individual. I would think that that's probably one of the things that really drew you to him.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
What was this, you know, as you go into such an early point in his career with Stealing Cinderella, he's songwriting. He was actually really new just in general to country music. He picked up a guitar in college for the first time.
Yeah.
Do you remember some of your sessions sitting down with Chuck Wicks?
The first one, he came in, he said, at the time he was dating a girl that it was playing Cinderella at Disney World. And
maybe
he said,
Heather, maybe? Maybe it was
named. I don't remember her name. I try not to get too involved in that side of his career.
I give him grief on every bit of ex-girlfriend drama in his life.
Well, he said, I feel like I'm stealing Cinderella from her dad, you know. And the look in his eye, and he said, that's my idea. Stealing Cinderella. I said, that's awesome. And he was so passionate about it. I knew it was going to be good. And when we wrote it, I knew it was a good song. Was it a hit? I have no idea.
Chuck Wicks came in prepared.
He came prepared. He did. He was ready, man. And honestly, when you're writing with a kid you've never met, never heard of, they got a record deal and they want you to write with him, you usually say, okay, well, that kid's going to sit in the corner and watch.
That's awesome.
And he came in and had an idea off the bat, and he's been a good friend and a great talent.
Really. I think he's a great. And that's before I got to know him through the show. I just think his music's really, he's got some cranked out some good stuff. And the whole damn thing, I think, is kind of similar. It reminds me of sort of the sentiment of Stealing Cinderella. Just, you can tell he means it when he sings stuff.
He means it. He does. Yeah. He does. He's a passionate guy.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I don't know from firsthand experience, but that's what
that's what Heather said. Or that's what Cinderella.
I don't go that way, but if I did, I'd pick Chuck, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Why not? So the other thing I was going to ask you, because we did go back and forth. You know, you got everything from like that the Kenny song that we heard a second, just a jam, burns, just something that kicks you in the ass right away, mm-hmm. to the Stealing Cinderella side or the very sentimental song that Brad Paisley eventually cut with Dolly. What do you find is an emotion that you really see a lot of connection from people regarding?
Arrogance.
Just self-centered and no.
I mean, in a sense, I do mean that. I don't know. I grew up on the south side of Memphis. You know, if you've been to Graceland Mansion in the past 40 years, you know that it's not a great part of town. I don't know. When you come from, you always feel like you have something to prove. And it's that, and arrogance, I'm kidding, but just that, screw them. This is how I do it. That I think resonates the most with me, and I think has been a big, big part of my career anyway.
So it's not about going in there and saying, let's write something that's about loss, or it's not about romance today, or it's not about this. It's just you want to connect on a level with a writer where you're coming at it from the same place, which is, for you, it sounds like, there's no limits. Let's just do this.
Yeah, I think that's important for a writer, too. I mean, it's really, they ought to just call us dreamer. That ought to be our title in life, you know. Why would you put a limit on your dreams? And if I've got an idea to write a song and I think, well, man, nobody in country music, like the song I just played, You Make Me Feel Good, that's not any countryer than, you know, Justin Timberlake or something. But the song, why would I limit myself and say, well, I got to make this country? I like writing songs, you know.
Well, Justin Timberlake and Rivers both come from Memphis.
That's right. He's a Memphis guy. That's right.
So between the time of being 9 years old writing nothing and today, has there been a point where you quit?
A couple times, actually, yeah. And I won't say quit. I tried to quit music when I got married. I thought I was choosing between, you know, music and party and all that and family. Mm-hmm. And I tried to sell real estate for 9 months, and I figured out that the only money I made wasn't selling real estate. It was playing in bars on the weekends. And so I woke my wife up one morning and said, let's move to Nashville. And she said, all right. So we were here before we'd been married a year, you know. And then here recently, probably a year ago, I took what I thought was going to be a short sabbatical, maybe a summer off. It really kind of turned into about 6 months. And I really thought through what do I want to do with my career? Where do I want to go from here? And I can't quit writing. I can't. I love doing it. I love music. I love to play for people and perform. I love to try to connect with people. You know, if I'm thinking this, surely somebody else out there has thought it. And it's a real high when I write a song that, A, really I'm proud of and I like it. That's a high in and of itself. But then playing it in front of an audience that's never heard it before and getting feedback that they're into it too, or they have felt it, or they get it, you know, mm-hmm. What's the movie Shadowlands? C.S. Lewis said, we read to know that we're not alone. And I think we listen to music for that reason too. And I know I write it for that reason.
I want to end the podcast though, the way that I often do. I ask people, you know, having a songwriter in the household and a lot of friends obviously from that are in the business. I know what a difficult time it is for songwriters, especially people that are just getting started in the business, man, because of the way that royalties work now.
Yeah, you know, honestly, and that was part of my dilemma a year ago. But now, you know, when I came to Nashville, it felt like climbing Mount Everest. And it was like that. It's so hard. It is so hard. There's so many people and so few slots. Now, you know, there were 3,500 people that were getting paid to write songs monthly on Music Row when I moved here. Today, it's probably about 350, 400. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a 90% loss in our ability to pay people. But there's more people than ever in Nashville coming here to write songs. Now it's like climbing Mount Everest, and you get to the top, and there's a little box, and you open it, and there's a note, and it says, congratulations, now go climb K2, and we'll talk. It is a difficult proposition, but, you know, if you're meant to do it, and I thought about going to seminary at one point in my life, and I had a preacher tell me, do everything in your power not to go to seminary. I think he knew me well enough to know this would be a catastrophe for the world if he was a preacher.
Sure.
And it didn't take me very long to get out of my system, but I took the same tack with music, writing songs. I tried everything to keep from being in the music business, and I just couldn't stay out, couldn't help it. And
still can't, it sounds like.
No, I still can't. And if that's you, it's not just a job. I mean, it's truly a calling, I think, you know. And if that's you, then come on, man, there's room, and you'll figure it out. You'll find a way.
Well, that answers the question that wasn't even asked then. So if you are a songwriter and you're considering coming to Nashville, clearly, Rivers Rutherford, you decided it's worth it. It was worth it in your day, and it's probably still worth it today if it's in your heart.
Absolutely.
All right, man. What's your favorite song you ever heard cut? Or what's one that stands out, let's say? Because I'm going to play it right now.
One of my songs or?
One of your songs.
Oh, gosh. That's a loaded question. Let's see. How about, you played most of them. You already played When I Get Where I'm Going, yeah. Real Good Man.
I would just go crazy. Let's go Gary on. Smoke Rings in the
there
Dark.
There we go.
Chuck,
that's
put
a
this
good
on here
call.
For us.
She was playing Cinderella. She was riding her first bike.
That right, bastard.
Rivers Rutherford, if you would like to go check him out, he's going to be out with the Music City Hitmakers at Cheekwood. It's Giant Songwriters Under the Stars evening. It's beautiful. It's awesome. It's a better date than I've been on in a long time. It happens every year. We went last year. If you miss it this year, plan for next year.
Come on.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.